From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a two-year FBI investigation into the passing of classified U.S. information to Israel first hit the headlines late last month. The news sparked charges of excessive Israeli influence on U.S. policy in the Middle East and countercharges of a witch hunt with anti-Semitic undertones. The scope of the investigation remains murky, but its outline suggests a half-curtained turf war in Washington, with assertive neoconservatives in the Pentagon clashing with the traditional intelligence apparatus. Tonight on Point, Israel, the Pentagon, and the battle in Washington over claims of influence and espionage. You can join the conversation. What was your first thought when claims of illegal passing of U.S. secrets to Israel hit the headlines? Are Israel and its advocates being unfairly tarred here? Or has Israel's influence in Bush's Washington somehow crossed lines that should not be crossed? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Bob Drogan, intelligence correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Bob, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
You've done some pretty in-depth reporting on this and pretty recently, but first, just take us back to late August when the story emerged. It came and went so quickly, people may have forgotten the outlines of it. What was it that hit the headlines there first, Bob?
The original story suggested that a mole in the Pentagon, that is a Pentagon official, was had been secretly passing information about Iran to members of a very large pro-Israel lobbying group in Washington known as AIPAC, and that AIPAC had allegedly passed this information on to, had passed it on to an Israeli embassy official. The alleged breach itself, that is the information on Iran, part of a proposed policy, that is just a draft document, was really not as important as the players who were part of this case, and that's what really made it into political dynamite.
Now, The case emerged. There was a report that this investigation was going on. It was in the papers for about a week, and then it essentially went away. Reporters, including yourself, have continued to look at this, many of them. But why has this gone essentially quiet again, Bob? What's happened here?
Well, I think two things. One is that, from what we're told, the administration, which was, and other people, which were leaking madly at the start of this thing, that an order came down to sort of put the lid on this, so it's been much harder to get information. And secondly, the nature of the case has been very hard for people to grasp. I think you described it and said the scope isn't clear. My thinking of it, the blind man and the elephant, we're not sure here whether we've got an elephant or a kangaroo or a chihuahua or what. It keeps sort of changing shape each time more information came out.
We understand that it had been going on for a couple of years before it suddenly hit headlines in August. Does anyone know what the origin of this was? Who instigated this investigation in the first place and why?
Well, that's not clear. That's one of the many things that aren't clear. The two-year investigation supposedly was looking at the role of AIPAC and whether or not the officials there were playing a role outside normal rules to pass information to Israel. A lot of people are quite mystified by that because AIPAC is such a prominent organization. It has such openly public access to the highest levels of government that it would seem unnecessarily and frankly just foolish and reckless to the extreme that it would do such a thing. Within the last 2 years, as an example, while this investigation has been going on, President Bush has spoken to the group, Secretary of State Powell has spoken to the group, Condi Rice has spoken to the group.
Bush not just spoken to it, but thanked AIPAC for raising the issue of the urgency of dealing with Iran and the nuclear weapons threat there.
So, as somebody said, why would Israel have to, steal information if they can get it for free? And they have extraordinary access in Washington, as is known, and it's very public, and not for sinister reasons. I mean, there's obviously people on both sides of the aisle, and going back to Harry Truman, have seen U.S. interests as being largely congruent with those of Israel.
But you have written that despite its status, Israel's practically unique status as an extremely close U.S. ally, that it presents a dilemma for U.S. counterintelligence officials. What is that dilemma, Bob Drogan?
Well, the dilemma is that despite those relations, Israel continues to spy on the United States. Now, Israel denies that. It's basically said that since the case of Michael Pollard, a Navy analyst who was caught and convicted and sentenced to life for spying for Israel in 1986. It insists that it stopped after that, but no one I know or have spoken to in the counterintelligence community accepts that. And they say, in fact, it's one of the two or three. If you had a list of the three or four largest and most active collectors in the United States, Israel would be in that top few. So, and one of the people who was involved in this case, the target who was being watched this case first came into public light, was an Israeli official, head of their political division, who has previously been in the FBI spotlight. So it's not a new issue for them.
So you, of course, the Israeli ambassador to the United States said on CNN, said, "I can tell you here very authoritatively, very categorically, Israel does not spy on the United States." Then you're quoting people, former intelligence people familiar with the FBI probe, saying there is a huge, this is one individual, there is a huge aggressive ongoing set of Israeli activities directed against the United States. Anybody who worked in counterintelligence in a professional capacity will tell you the Israelis are among the most aggressive and active countries targeting the United States, and by targeting this former official meant targeting with espionage efforts, I guess, or intelligence efforts anyway.
Yes, I mean, Israel clearly has its own self-interest, you know, in terms of what it sees as its threats in the region, and it views it obviously within its interest to gain knowledge about what U.S. policy is and to do whatever it can to influence those policy. And I'm talking about issues about Syria, about Iraq, about Saudi Arabia, about Lebanon, and especially about Iran, which it views as the number one threat. The United States and Israel have had some differences on the nature of the threat from Iran under the current regime there and what best to do about it. And that's clearly the most the issue that's most important. Just an hour ago, I got an email from the public relations person from AIPAC sending new information about the growing threat from Iran. I mean, this is their number one lobbying priority.
I should say we invited AIPAC to join our conversation tonight. A spokesman for the group said they'd be happy to talk about issues about Iran or American and Israeli foreign policy, but they had no more to say about the FBI investigation. Bob Drogan, what is known about where that investigation stands now? Is it still going on? Has it been deflated by all this?
Let me, what AIPAC has said is that they consider this story to be baseless and false. That is, any allegation that AIPAC was involved in spying. And frankly, no one has been charged. No one has been arrested.
Right.
No one has been indicted.
Right.
There are really a lot more questions about this case than there is hard information. You have three major players in Washington wrapped up in this. You've got Israel, you've got AIPAC, one of the most powerful lobbying groups, and then you have the Pentagon office of Douglas Feith, the undersecretary for policy, and his organization, which is his office over there, which has been very involved in collecting intelligence on the war before the war in Iraq, and has sort of been a target for a lot of people.
Bob Drogan, stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation with me here in the studio in Boston, Stephen Walt. He's professor of international relations and academic dean at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's author of Revolution and War. Stephen Walt, welcome.
Nice to be here.
So you have read all of this in the press. You hear Bob Drogan with the latest tonight, the latest call he's getting from AIPAC. From your vantage, what is the window that was opened up in August when news of this investigation hit the headlines? What are we getting a glimpse into here? It's confusing for most people looking in to try and figure out. What do you think?
Well, I think for people who followed this issue, the first thing is it reminded everyone that Israel, like lots of other countries, has conducted espionage activities in the United States. The United States conducts espionage activities against other countries as well. The GAO, the General Accounting Office, a nonpartisan branch of government, did conclude in 1996 that Israel conducts, and I'm quoting here, the most aggressive espionage activities against the United States of any U.S. ally. And it's not just a normal U.S. ally. It's the largest recipient of American foreign aid, a country that depends upon the United States for diplomatic support and military protection.
So is this a scandal, or is this just, as you kind of suggest, just the way the world works? I mean, the U.K. must have its...
It's in a sense, it's both. It's not an uncommon practice, but it is a case where when a country that regards itself or tries to portray itself as a very close American ally, mm-hmm. very supportive of American interests, tries to convince us that its interests are essentially identical with ours, is engaged in this sort of thing. That's, I think, cause for some pause. The second thing that I think was the window that got exposed in August was the influence that Israel and through institutions like AIPAC and others, the influence that Israel now enjoys over American policy in the Middle East. It's not as though we have any reason to believe that there were some really precious national security secrets being revealed by this. Mm. But what it shows is how it has, in a sense, become almost normal practice for Israel as a government, but also to some degree AIPAC, to try and shape American policy in this very critical region through a whole variety of mechanisms. Now, we've all known for a long time about their influence in Congress, which is practiced in a number of means. This was, I think, a window into the influence they are now beginning to enjoy within the executive branch. And as Bob Grogan was saying earlier, not only were they very influential in trying to get the United States to go to war with Iraq, where Israel was really the only country in the world that was egging us on to do that, but since then have been trying to get the United States to take the question of Iranian intentions and Iran's nuclear ambitions much more seriously. This also goes back to before the war with Iraq, when it was quite clear that these sort of large plans for regional transformation, you know, first Baghdad, then Syria, then Iran, was being promoted primarily by Israel and by Israel's supporters in the United States. And I think that was the other thing that got revealed by this particular episode.
So Bob Grogan, it still leaves a lot of people, I think, scratching their heads about what are the forces arrayed within the U.S. government that would lead to, you know, an FBI investigation gets launched. That doesn't happen out of nowhere. If the Bush administration, if the Bush administration is so close and warmly close and openly close to Israel, then who's the force that's getting an investigation going on that goes after powerful AIPAC, that goes after Pentagon officials that would, if it's wrong, would really be smearing Israel?
One of the things that's unclear here, Tom, is whether these were separate investigations that intersected and have subsequently been sort of conflated into one, or whether it was one seamless probe.
What do you mean by separate? You said it began with a look at AIPAC, as I understood.
What we know is that there has been an investigation of some kind into AIPAC over the last 2 years, and what we know is that the United States, that the FBI routinely surveils foreign diplomats, including those from Israel. There was a surveillance of a lunch between an Israeli diplomat and two officials from AIPAC. Whether they were at that point watching the AIPAC guys or watching the Israeli diplomat, the head of the political affairs division at that point, is still a little unclear.
Right.
What happened during that lunch is a Pentagon official walked into it and they said, whoa, who's this guy and what's he doing? And then they began to follow him. So you have sort of a separate things sort of combining in one place. At what point it became a ostensible espionage case is a little unclear, but not until the Pentagon official showed up was there even this hint of classified information being transferred over, as far as we know.
Stephen Wald, here's a question then. In the run-up to the Iraq War, the Pentagon famously developed its own kind of maverick intelligence operation under Douglas Feith that was very influential in stovepiping intelligence, we were told at the time, and perhaps pushing the White House to war. Are we seeing in this investigation and its leak, are we seeing the revenge of the traditional intelligence community that felt set up for the blame for Iraq and wanted to take a piece out of the Pentagon?
I don't find that very persuasive. First of all, the FBI doesn't really have a foreign policy agenda, right? The FBI is forbidden from engaging in foreign intelligence operations. There are plenty of people in the Central Intelligence Agency, plenty of people in the Defense Intelligence Agency that are very upset about the way the intelligence process was manipulated and screwed up before the war.
But could the CIA or the State Department be egging the FBI on to take those boys down a notch over there?
Again, that's not very likely because, again, the FBI and the CIA, as we know from the whole war on terrorism, are not exactly buddies. They don't exactly engage in this kind of collaboration. The FBI has a domestic counterintelligence function. It's been pursuing that against lots of countries, against lots of possibilities, and I think this is much more a case of standard operating procedure by the FBI. They're not concerned with the political agenda. They don't really care about any president's foreign policy priorities or whether or not he's going to get elected, at least not over an issue like that. I don't find the idea that this is some kind of after the Iraq War witch hunt or payback very persuasive.
Bob Grogan, just 20 seconds here. The FBI does, it would appear, pay attention to political imperatives. Has this essentially been shut down? Is the Bush White House saying that that's enough of this investigation or not, or do we know?
Well, we don't know. What we know is that the Israeli ambassador said last week that he's been assured that there's nothing of this and it will go away. And lo and behold, it went away in about 24 hours. Whether that was a decision that was made or, you know, it's in the hands of the U.S. attorney in the in Northern Virginia. At this
Bob Drogon, we're out of time. We so appreciate your coming on. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Bob Drogon at the L.A. Times. We're talking about Israel and the Pentagon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israel and the Pentagon and the battle in Washington over claims of influence and espionage. You can join the conversation tonight. What was your first thought when claims of illegal passing of U.S. secrets to Israel hit the headlines last month? And between such close allies, does a charge of espionage even make sense? And I guess this, have you felt the silence that descended on the story within days? What's that about? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I have been joined in the studio tonight by Stephen Walt, professor of international relations at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author of Revolution and War. We're joined now from New York by Andrew McCarthy. He's a contributor to the National Review Online, former chief assistant U.S. attorney. He led the 1995 terrorism prosecution against Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, the blind sheikh, and 11 others. Andrew McCarthy, thank you for joining us tonight.
Good evening. How are you?
We're great. You've thought and written about this whole thing quite a lot. What's your sense of what's going on here, Andrew McCarthy, with the headlines that hit the press, two, 3 weeks ago, and then fell away? What's happening?
Well, I guess what I'm struck by is just the utterly irresponsible leakage of active investigative information under circumstances where the government is evidently not ready to bring criminal charges.
Okay, it may be irresponsible, but it's hardly the first time. I mean, this is the big leagues, hardball. Things get leaked a lot.
No. Well, things get leaked a lot, but there's usually a very hard line that's drawn in government between the leaking of information. I should preliminarily say that the leaks are wrong and they shouldn't happen, and they, in the long run, hurt the law enforcement mission. But leaving that aside, there's a qualitative difference between leaking information before people have been charged,
right,
in the way that was done in this case, and leaking information after people have been charged about broader outlines of the investigation.
Which I have to say that was odd. Usually this dribble begins just before some concrete step takes place, like formal charges. That didn't happen.
Right. And I think that's it really is not only outrageous, I think it's contributed to the climate that has existed over the last 3 weeks or so, where you know, the story really has gotten, I think, inflated and out of hand.
But somebody wanted it out there, and they got it out there in a pretty big way. What is your interpretation? You've been on the inside here as a prosecutor, U.S. attorney. What's going on? What went on? What are the forces at work here?
One thing I've learned, I think, over the years is that things rarely happen for one reason. And you, I think, can detect a number of different streams of motivation here. One of them is that the FBI group, including the supervisor who's evidently in charge of the investigation, was itself the target of a fairly stinging report by 60 Minutes, the same outfit to which this was leaked in the first instance.
Okay.
A year ago in connection with Robert Hansen, the famous FBI spy.
And what was the complaint that the 60 Minutes was suggesting?
That they, well, it wasn't just that they were suggesting. It was a well-established complaint that was the subject of an internal Justice Department review.
And what was it?
That this same group spent about 3 years, if I'm remembering the time frame correctly, investigating the wrong person because they rejected, without much rationale, the possibility that the person right under their nose, Robert Hansen, an FBI employee, could conceivably be the Russian mole.
So you're just suggesting that this is all the result of a crank or an incompetent in the FBI?
No, what I said was that things rarely happen.
One piece, all right, maybe, okay.
I think one of the motives that exists here is that the FBI wants to show, and I think it's interesting that they went right to 60 Minutes, which is the source of the last place they got publicly routed on this, They want to show that they're competent and they can do a good investigation and get from point A to point B. And I think in this case, they may have gotten to point B before they had it in an evidentiary sense in the bag.
Yeah.
On the other side of the coin, I heard what Professor Walt said, and I agree with it to some extent. The FBI, at least in my experience, does not have a foreign policy agenda, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the people from whom they get information, their sources, don't have an agenda and an axe to grind. And I think it would be foolish or naive, given what we have seen in the public reports, particularly since the whole Iraq military operation, to deny the fact that there is at times a heated relationship between the one faction of fairly hawkish intelligence types, some of whom are centered in the Defense Department.
The so-called neocons, yeah.
Right, and the rest of the intelligence community, which, you know, had a different idea about how to handle Iraq and has a different idea about how to handle Iran.
Let me ask you something on that
sure.
point. Michael
yep.
Rubin at the American Enterprise Institute has called this investigation the criminalization of the foreign policy debate. That is suggesting that, you know, there's a debate here, but by turning it into an FBI investigation, someone has tried to criminalize it. Do you see that going on?
Yeah, I think that that's a... I wouldn't want to leap to a conclusion. I wouldn't want to do the same thing that that I'm in a way accusing law enforcement of doing, which is getting out ahead of the facts. But I do think that that's a very serious thing to be concerned about, and that there's a lot of good reason to be concerned about it. You know, there are very serious, compelling points to be made on both sides for the approach we should take in Iran, the approach we should take in Iraq, in the greater Middle East. You would like to think that the adults would kind of get everybody in a room and try to beat out some consensus, understanding that everybody can agree and you know, there will be disagreement. But to see this played out as it's played out with really craven, anonymous catcalling back and forth and bringing in the FBI to investigate things which, you know, frankly, in some instances go on every day without criminal enforcement, namely the murky world of interchange between people who have access to both classified information and open source information every single day in Washington are meeting with people outside government who are interested in policy.
So keep the FBI out of that, you're saying. Andrew McCarthy, stand by. I want to turn back to Stephen Walt for a moment. Stephen, Andrew raises the issue of, well, what's the impact on Middle East policy? Shouldn't we, you know, work this out in a civilized way? You know that the charge that's kind of running beneath all this is a dual loyalty charge, that there's a group of policy mavens within the U.S. government that is not loyal only to U.S. interests, but also to Israeli interests, right or wrong. That's the context for this. Do you see merit in that? And B, what is or what might be the impact on U.S. policy if even if that's not true, but rather there's a kind of running together of interests here.
Yeah. I don't like the term dual loyalty because it's a code word. It has a sort of historical references back in sort of the long history of anti-Semitism. So I don't like to use that. I think a more legitimate question to ask is whether or not there's a conflict of interest here between a number of U.S. officials who have made no secret, quite the contrary, made no secret about their strong affinities, strong commitment to the state of Israel, which as Americans, they are perfectly entitled to have, but who are also in very critical policymaking positions vis-a-vis American Middle East policy. And, you know, you if your stockbroker recommended a stock to you and didn't tell you that the company was owned by his brother, you'd have reasons to think he was guilty of a conflict of interest.
Except as you say, this hasn't been undercover. They've been very open. Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith, Richard Perle, and these guys have sometimes worked or consulted to the the Israeli government a fife and pearl.
But there's one.
They'd be very open.
No, that's true. But it's one thing to have sort of a policies out in the open. It's also another thing to have people who are working for those same individuals passing classified information, outlining American policy, in this case towards Iran, to individuals, first of all, who work for a lobbying organization that works very hard in a variety of ways to shape American policy towards this region, and second, to have that passed on to a government that, again, has a very real interest. And the key here, and it was said by Andrew as well, that our interests may be parallel in some ways, but our interests are not identical. And one of the things Americans have to ask themselves is whether or not they would like the U.S. policy towards this part of the world to be shaped so heavily by a country that has its own interests. One can disagree about that. Reasonable people can have a reasonable argument about it, but the question ought to get raised. And it seems to me that's what this incident sort of puts in bright lights. Shouldn't we be looking at exactly the motivations of the people who are conducting our policy? And shouldn't we be asking about what the effects that may be having, particularly in an era where we have a war on terrorism and where our policies in the Middle East are fueling that war?
We should say, to be very clear, that allegation of passing through AIPAC is wholly unproven.
No. And
AIPAC completely denies it. Let's go to our callers. Michael is calling from College Station, Texas. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I just wanted to push a little bit further on this issue that Steve Walt and you were discussing before, the question of the conflation of American and Israeli national interests, which it seems to me is the larger issue behind the story, whether the espionage case actually works itself out or not. And I've been thinking about this because I'm reading Dennis Ross's book, The Missing Piece. Ross was the chief Middle Eastern negotiator for the Clinton administration. And a sort of striking thing that comes out of that book is how thoroughly he identifies with the Israeli position and, you know, regards himself as representing the Israelis in his negotiation with Arafat and the Palestinians.
Well, I don't know if Dennis Ross would put it that way. I mean, he's represented the U.S. government in those conversations.
No, but if you read the book, it's quite interesting because he's not an honest broker. And you know, at one point he tells Prime Minister Netanyahu, you know, come on, help me out here. I'm representing your interests in this particular phase of the negotiations. But the thing is that there's and this is why I thought the stream in which the discussion was going was so important, that a lot of people just naturally assume that American interests and Israeli interests will be congruent all the time. And, you know, they are a lot of the time, but it seems to me that this, you know, assumption that the United States and Israel will always have completely compatible interests is really problematic. And I really would, you know, recommend looking closely again at the Ross book, because it's remarkable how often Ross is negotiating on behalf of the Israelis with the Palestinians and really doesn't come off as much of an honest broker at all in the discussions.
Michael, we'll take your interpretation for the moment, though I'm sure at other points he's represented the Palestinian interest to the Israelis. But clearly it gets tricky here. Stephen Walt, let's just pick up the substance of Michael's focus here. And U.S. interest in the Middle East, Israeli interests in the Middle East, there is more than a tendency to see them as essentially the same. How fair is that? Where is that true? Where is that untrue?
There are a number of places where I think the interests are largely congruent. I think I agree with the thrust of his point, which is to say that they're not certainly not identical in every way. I mean, give you one good example. The United States has, until very recently, basically been opposed to any policy of territorial expansion on the part of the state of Israel, and we have openly advocated and sought a viable homeland for the Palestinian people, because we recognized as Americans that it was in our long-term national interest to have the Israeli-Palestinian conflict come to an end. That's not, I think, a consensus view necessarily within Israel, certainly about territorial adjustments. They would like, obviously, the conflict to come to an end, but only on, I think, a particular set of terms. So there's an issue where what would really be good for the United States in terms of winning the war on terrorism may not be something that many Israelis accept, and certainly not that the Sharon government, it seems to me, would accept.
The Likud party. What about Iran, Iraq?
Again, I think the United States and Iran, the United States and Israel, both have reasons to be concerned about Iran's nuclear ambitions. Whereas it would be, very much be in Israel's short-term interest to get the United States into a military conflict with Iran, it seems to me that would very much not be in our interests. It's quite clear that the Likud party was trying to egg the United States on first Iraq and then possibly Iran. And in the first wave after the Iraq War, when it seemed to go so well, Prime Minister Sharon was sort of saying, you know, now we got to deal with the more serious problem, which is Iran. Now, some of that died down for a while when it turned out Iraq didn't work out so well and we got bogged down there. But you've seen in the last 6 months or so that these drumbeats have started to echo again. And again, Americans ought to ask themselves, not is it in Israel's interest for us to go after Iran, but rather would it be in the United States' national interest to get into a military confrontation with a country like Iran, given what we've already seen happen in a place like Iraq? The United States does not want to be in a position where it's basically going up against the entire Arab and Islamic world. Fortunately, if we allow our foreign policy to be dictated by the most extreme elements in the Israeli polity, that could be where we end up. That's one of these places where the interests seems to be start to separate. And again, to get back to where we started, that's what this episode may be showing us, that the relationship between the United States and some parts of the Pentagon, between some parts of the Pentagon in the United States, some American officials, and the state of Israel has gotten to be a little bit too intimate, a little bit too incestuous.
But Andrew McCarthy, your point is, if there are policy differences, if there are issues, let's sit down and talk them out publicly, not turn to the FBI to turn it into a criminal investigation.
Well, that's one of my points. Another point I have is that I hear again and again this certitude that the FISE office, or you know, a component of the Pentagon, are being run as sort of a proxy for the Likud party, and I don't see any evidence for it. And you know, I must say I know some of those guys. I have no doubt that they look, I consider myself to be a strong supporter of Israel. I don't think that I'd have any hesitation whatsoever of siding with my own country where I thought that was where it was in American interest to do so.
Sure.
I haven't detected anything on the part of those people at the Pentagon that indicates to me that they're wired any differently. And the fact that they're supporters of Israel doesn't necessarily mean that they have any confusion about where they're at when the time comes that there's a parting of the ways between American interests and Israeli interests. I just don't see it.
Stephen Walt, it may be too easy to assert or suggest that there's a confusion of interests here. What do you say?
Again, I think that's a question that can be or should be openly debated. I mean, we do know that a number of individuals in the current administration, Doug Feith being a good example, but by no means the only one, have very close ties, not just to the state of Israel as a sort of concept, but to the Likud party as well. Feith, for example, in the 1990s worked as a consultant for Likud, wrote position papers for Israeli think tanks and things like that, has had a law practice, had connections to Israel as well. It's not just a crime. There's nothing illegitimate about that. That's perfectly reasonable. The question is whether or not when he does things that he regards as being in the American interest and in the Israeli interest, we have a right to then evaluate and say, well, we don't agree. And that debate tends not to happen in the United States because people are very concerned about being regarded as anti-Israeli or anti-Semitic.
Stephen Walt, Andrew McCarthy, stand by. We're talking about Israel and the Pentagon, claims of influence and espionage. 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israel and the Pentagon and the battle in Washington over claims of influence and espionage. My guests in the studio tonight, Stephen Walt, professor of international relations and academic dean at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And joining us from New York, Andrew McCarthy, a contributor to the National Review Online, former chief assistant U.S. attorney. You can join the conversation as well. A lot of questions here. Are Israel and its advocates being unfairly tarred with this FBI investigation and leaks? Or has Israel's influence in George Bush's Washington gone too far, crossed some line that should not be crossed? Are American and Israeli interests today essentially identical, or are there worthy distinctions that have been blurred or ignored? Is AIPAC being smeared or ultimately shielded in this FBI investigation? What about Israel? Is this all a tempest in a teacup, or is it a problem? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 8255. Jerry is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Ashbrook. First, I have a question of you before I ask my question of Professor Walker.
Fire away, Jerry.
Yeah. You use the word espionage. As you probably know, we have station chiefs all over the world that are in every country in the world gathering information. One could infer from your remarks that they're doing espionage. I don't believe that so, and I don't think our government agrees that they're
doing
espionage.
The United States certainly does have forces that undertake espionage, and they're supposed to. That's their job, right?
That's information gathering. Okay, but Professor Walt, I think you made the point that there are no hard facts about it, and I think the gentleman from the Los Angeles Times did the same thing. If there are no hard facts, why are they going after Israel? Is somebody trying to scapegoat Israel? And when Mr. Ashbrook raised the question of dual loyalty, you sort of said that has a code word for anti-Semitism. Is there some of that going on right now?
Stephen Walt.
I don't think so. I think that it's possible to discuss these matters from sort of the perspective of the American national interest. I wanted to stay away from that phrase dual loyalty because, again, it has these historical connotations that I think are tremendously unfortunate. I also find there's no evidence sort of in this discussion that people are slandering individuals they disagree with politically because of their heritage. It's worth noting that some of the neoconservatives whose policies, for example, I might disagree with aren't even Jewish. And there's plenty of Jewish Americans who think the policies that the Bush administration has followed in the Middle East and elsewhere are quite damaging. So this is not an issue of sort of one's ethnic background or religious beliefs or anything like that.
But Stephen, let me ask you, Andrew McCarthy raised this. I'll put it to him as well. But he said the leaking itself in the absence of charges has got right. a kind of funny smell to it.
Well, not necessarily. Among other things, we don't know who did the leaking, right? And if you're worried about where an investigation is going, sometimes the targets of the investigation are the ones who might be the ones leaking the information.
Get it out there and hope that it gets crushed.
Exactly. So yes, it's possible that this was a case of some people on the sort of prosecutorial side getting out ahead of themselves. It's also possible that people who saw the posse coming decided to sort of raise the alarm and get it out in public where they knew it would then get quickly suppressed. We just don't know. But, you know, there is this larger question, and we shouldn't lose sight of it.
Yeah.
It's not even an open secret. It's widely acknowledged. It's trumpeted, in fact, by AIPAC itself, that this is a lobbying organization that has tremendous influence.
Fortune magazine, 3 years ago, ranked at number 4 on the list of Washington's 25 most powerful lobbying groups, ahead of the AFL-CIO, ahead of the American Medical Association.
And a lot
of clout.
And a key point to make here is there's nothing illegitimate about this. The American political system is based on special interest groups, whether it's, you know, retirees or textile farmers.
Get in there and mix it up. That's the way.
That's right. And they've been extraordinarily good about it, extraordinarily effective. It is nonetheless worth asking whether or not their influence on American foreign policy is in the broader national interest. Again, one isn't making any comments about loyalty, about people's beliefs, anything like that. It's simply asking whether or not in an era where the United States has tremendous problems now with the Arab and Islamic world, where terrorists are clearly inspired by some of the policies we have adopted, where, in my view, our rather one-sided and unconditional support for Israeli policy has been very damaging for Israel itself, which is, you know, facing all sorts of internal problems and continues to suffer. It's worth having an open conversation about that without sort of getting too wrapped around the axle or too emotional about particular national origins or particular beliefs.
Andrew McCarthy, Stephen Walt suggests the possibility that the leak itself may not have come from the FBI, but from somebody who was being pursued. You've been inside this whole world. Does that make sense to you at all?
No. Well, let me. That's a little too cavalier. I think Professor Walt's point, as a general academic matter, is true. Leaks do come from all kinds of sources.
Yeah.
They can come from anyone who knows about the investigation.
For all kinds of reasons.
The particular leaks in this case have to have come from inside the investigation because of the detail at an extremely early stage, beginning with the very first reports to CBS, of an extraordinary amount of information, not only about the information, but precisely who was running it, exactly what kinds of evidence they had, how long the investigation had been going on, et cetera. This is the kind of investigative detail and minutia that is available only to at that early stage If there ever is a case, should that ever happen, if it gets litigated, that's another story, because then all kinds of information gets into the public domain.
But it came out within a few days of these headlines that leak itself...
It came out the first day.
No, I'm saying within a few days of the headlines, it emerged. We heard people from the FBI saying, you know what, this coming out may have damaged this investigation. And now in Time magazine, they're quoting a bureau official saying, we may never know what really happened or how big and wide it was, because it kind of got spiked by all the publicity.
Yeah, well, I don't believe that. I, you know, respectfully think that that's a fairly clever thing to do if you're involved in, and I don't say that the person who said that was necessarily involved, but, you know, look, in this instance, the public reports are that they actually served a search warrant or executed a search warrant on the very same day that they showed up to speak to two of the AIPAC people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same day that the information was originally leaked to CBS. Now, if you intend to continue with the covert portion of an investigation, the last two things you do on the planet Earth are execute a search warrant on a target business and try to brace two people, not one, to get them to cooperate. When you take those steps, and I'm not saying they're not worthy steps to take, they're steps that are taken in many investigations.
What does it suggest, though?
You take them with the knowledge that the covert part of your investigation is over because you've revealed it to the people that you're investigating.
And what would that suggest?
It suggests that it's inconceivable that they thought that there were other things that they might be able to do in connection with the covert investigation.
I don't know, because just days before, I see other reports here that they were having Larry Franklin, the Pentagon official, in the headlights here, having Larry Franklin call an official in Iraq trying to see if there was some connection between Chalabi
That may not be the same well, I guess two things. Number one, that may be a different investigative track, number one. But number two, I'm referring to a moment in time, namely August 27th. I have no doubt that prior to August 27th, they may have had all kinds of things that they could have done.
But and you're saying, down it likely went. Let me get one more call here. Ellen is calling from Traverse City, Michigan. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just want to go back in history when the United States was the first country to recognize Israel. Harry Truman realized that there is a special relationship with this country. They are the only democracy that is in that country, in that whole area, and they should be realized as the only democracy. And as a result, they can be counted upon forever forward to be that kind of a partner for us.
And what does that mean, Ellen? Does it mean that the United States should not be critical of their relationship, or that its policies, its interests are the same as Israel's, or is there still room for, you know, a critical attitude between tight, close allies?
Well, as you know, in the state of Israel, there is controversy about which way they
sure
should
is.
Go and what they should do. And they are a close family. Obviously, in any family, there's going to be differing views. But what we need to remember is that they are our allies right there. And they are the only ones that can be counted upon to always be, as compared to Saudi Arabia, which we don't know where we stand with that country.
Ellen, we've got it. Thanks very much for your call. Stephen Walt, the last word goes to you. We've just got a minute and a half. The big issues that you've raised are, let's look at whether or not we really have a congruence of interest here, and let's be able to discuss that openly as we ought to find the right answer, the right policy. Your thoughts as we go out.
I guess I want to pick up on the last question a little bit, because certainly the view she represented is widespread. It's sort of an article of faith, I think, certainly among groups like AIPAC. And there's clearly something to it.
And many Americans of all stripes look at Israel and see that.
That's right. And one of the reasons I think why we feel a certain degree of comfort with the state of Israel is the sense of shared values. But I make a couple of other points. We have lots of democracies in the world, and we don't have the same kind of relationship with all of them. The mere fact that a country is democratic isn't, I think, enough to justify the really quite extraordinary relationship. The United States, for example, now gives about $500 per year per Israeli in foreign aid, and that's not something we do for other democracies. The second point is that the Israeli democracy has its flaws, too. It's not the same kind of democracy. It's not a melting pot democracy like the United States, and it's one that continues to rule over an occupied population that is denied virtually all political rights. And that's something Americans, as people who believe in democracy, should be uncomfortable with. So, well, again, the interests are similar, but they're not identical.
So here is a tight alliance, but still a conversation goes on. With that, we're out of time. Stephen Walt, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Professor of International Relations and Academic Dean at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, Stephen Walt, and Andrew McCarthy in New York, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Good evening to you, Tom, and to Professor Walt. Thank you.
Andrew McCarthy, former Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney and contributor to the National Review Online. In a moment, the campaign spotlight turns to domestic issues. This is On Point. With just 7 weeks before Election Day now, the candidates for president and vice president turned to domestic issues on the campaign trail today. John Kerry lambasted President Bush for not doing more to extend the assault weapons ban, which expired early this morning, and said the president paid for his tax cuts by taking police off the street. The president and vice president, meanwhile, focused on health care the same day that their campaign released a new ad saying that Kerry wants to create a, quote, government-run, unquote, health care system. Last week, we checked in with Democratic vice presidential candidate John Edwards in New Hampshire. Tonight, we bring you Vice President Dick Cheney speaking today in Ottumwa, Iowa.
We also need to focus very much on health care, because health care, both from the standpoint of the availability of health care for our folks here at home, the cost of it, as well as its impact on our ability to build a strong, healthy, viable economy. Because in the final analysis, if you look the problem, for example, with respect to the uninsured in America, about 60% of the uninsured population in the country are, in fact, employees of small businesses. And making it possible for businesses to be able to afford to pay for benefits for their employees is a vital part of what we need to do to guarantee that we can have the strong, healthy economies here in the United States that are essential for us. One of the most important things the President did this year, again together with the Congress, was our Medicare reform legislation. For the first time, we're going to have prescription drug benefits available through the Medicare system to our seniors. That program will kick in early 2006. We were already started down that road with respect to the Medicare drug discount card that's now available. Several million American senior citizens have enrolled in that as well, too. And that program's vital going forward. Our opponents voted against it. There was a study released just today by a nonpartisan think tank in Washington that estimates that his package will cost about $1.5 trillion. It basically breaks the bank. There isn't any way you can have a program that large and to pick up that much of a cost without ultimately generating probably the need for a broad-scale increase in taxes pretty much across the board. And so it's important as we go forward this year, we'll have this debate over health care. It's very important. But we've got a clear distinction out there between the president, who has done something very significant in this area, who, for example, among other things, is recommending that we have a health association so small businesses can pool their assets and be able to get the big kind of discounts for their employees that large corporations do. That we talk about refundable tax credit for small business owners to be able to contribute to health savings accounts for their employees. Series of proposals that are already in law or on the books that will be vital to reduce our overall health care costs and make it more available to the American people.
Vice President Dick Cheney speaking earlier today in Ottumwa, Iowa. Many more speeches to come in this campaign season, and we will bring them to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.